I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. It's been almost 5 years since President Obama signed an executive order closing the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, and just 12 years since the first detainees arrived from Afghanistan. Almost 800 prisoners have been held at the notorious center since it opened, and today there are 155. About half have been cleared for transfer, while the rest are in a kind of legal limbo. Carol Rosenberg has been reporting on Guantanamo Bay since the arrival of the first prisoners, and she joins us on Radio Times. She's military affairs correspondent for the Miami Herald. She tweets from Guantanamo live when she's there. And Carol Rosenberg, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
I'm curious about your first impression, and this would be just about 12 years ago when those first detainees arrived at Guantanamo Bay. You were there. What did the facility look like?
Well, when we first arrived there, they were building something that looked like kennels. They were chain-link cages, and we were brought to see them before the detainees arrived. And what we had were, if you close your eyes and imagine men in orange jumpsuits kneeling inside a cage, we saw Navy Seabees engineers building those cages out in an abandoned kind of crude corner of the base near the minefield with Cuba.
And what does it look like today?
Well, today they've spent close to $5 billion building a far more permanent, sprawling detention center on a different portion of the Navy base that includes two prison buildings that would look like a prison anywhere in the USA, an outdoor movie theater for the entertainment of the guards, dining facilities, a snoop-proof, you can't eavesdrop or, you know, listen in on headquarters for the commander of the prison operation where they have keep their intelligence information. It looks like a entrenched U.S. military operation in a portion of Guantanamo Bay Navy Base behind a special gate.
You use the word permanent and entrenched. Are you telling us that you think Guantanamo will stay open?
Well, it's hard to imagine them getting out of this thing anytime soon. You know, there's 155 men there, as you say, and the plan that this president has that would close down that facility would require moving at least some of these men to detention in the United States. And as you know, I think Congress has blocked that. They will not allow men who are held at Guantanamo to set foot on U.S. soil. And so absent the ability to take at least some of them out and lock them up or put them on trial or find a facility for them in the United States, it's hard to imagine them shutting down that detention center.
Now, there are how many prisoners that have been actually cleared for release?
As of this moment, there's 77 on a list that could go. If the U.S. felt that it had adequate, comfortable security measures in which either people would be rehabilitated or resettled or in some way monitored by the country where they were sent, the U.S. is willing to send these 77 men away. The vast majority of them are Yemeni, but they want assurances. They don't want to just open the doors and let them go. They feel that if they weren't given a shot at their next life, this could be a problem for us in the future.
How do you get assurances from a country like Yemen?
Well, there's lots of talk that the U.S., through international organizations, is interested in building a rehabilitation or a rehabilitation center or possibly another kind of Guantanamo lockup, depending on which version you read. So there's some sort of behind-the-scenes negotiations going on to try to set up maybe Guantanamo in Yemen.
Really? I mean, Guantanamo being a kind of a detention facility to hold people there, what, indefinitely?
Well, that's the thing. We really don't know what they're planning for Yemen. We know that there's a lot of negotiations and discussions going on, that one of the ways to close the detention center means moving them, and the administration hasn't been particularly forthcoming on what it is they're trying to set up in Yemen. You know, Saudi Arabia some years ago set up a rehabilitation center. It was a way to take men in and give them a different kind of Islamic instruction that's maybe not quite as fundamentalist jihadi and help them find jobs and, in some instances, wives and new lives. And That rehabilitation center has been somewhat criticized because a few of those men went on to turn up in Yemen with a new Al-Qaeda franchise called Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. So there's some concern over what kind of rehabilitation center could be built. But the bottom line is, as you said, 77 of these men are good to go if the U.S. can figure out how to move them on to the next phase of their lives.
Well, I'm actually looking at a piece you did in December about two Guantanamo prisoners sent to Sudan. And, of course, as we know, Sudan, a very unsettled country in Africa.
Absolutely. But those two men left by finding their way out of Guantanamo through the courts, something most of these men have not gotten satisfaction. And one of them pleaded guilty and as to war crimes at the military commissions, admitted to being a war criminal and got a definitive sentence. And the other man who arrived, 12 years ago, day before yesterday, was found to be just too ill, too sick to be a threat to the United States in the future. The lawyer made the argument, the U.S. Justice Department agreed, and the judge ordered him released. So those two men went home to Sudan, yes, an unsettled country, but with case-by-case analysis that they would not become, or likely would not become, a threat in the future.
And that's Carol Rosenberg. She's been reporting on Guantanamo Bay since the arrival of the first prisoners. This is 12 years ago, just this past weekend. She's a military affairs correspondent for the Miami Herald. We have called her up from time to time over about the last 12 years to talk about Guantanamo. And she does a tweet live from Guantanamo when she is there. There are these, I think, almost 50 what are described, Carol, as forever detainees. Help us understand how they got that designation.
They're basically war prisoners. These are a category of captive that the United States has designed through this war on terror with Al-Qaeda following September 11th. And what they've done is they've sort of taken the Geneva Conventions, which is are intended for a very specific kind of war, and they've turned it on its head. They've said, basically, these are POWs in a war on terror, a forever war. Some people liken it to the drug war, without borders and not with the capacity to have a leader sign an armistice agreement in the end. And they've said that these 46 men, actually 45 as of a few days ago, these 45 men are POWs in this forever war, and that they are not ever going to be tried because the United States either lacks evidence they didn't do anything that would constitute a crime, or if they are suspected of having done something that constituted a crime, they were treated so poorly, their interrogations were so harsh, they would shock the conscience of a judge and a jury, and they would be acquitted. So these 45 men never get trials. They never get released. They do get parole board hearings that the President Obama has decided they should have, called periodic review boards, in which they will have an opportunity to argue that they should not be in this category, and they should be have that label removed from them, and they should be entitled, like the other cleared men at Guantanamo, to find a new place to go, start new lives. And the process began late last year, and actually one of these forever prisoners has now been reclassified and is entitled to go back to, unfortunately, Yemen, where we are reluctant to send people. But he's off that list, on a new list, and we're waiting whatever becomes the next thing for him in his Guantanamo detention.
And he has been called Osama bin Laden's bodyguard. Who is this person?
Well, that man's name is Mahmoud Mujahid. And what I think you need to know about the Osama bin Laden bodyguard collection is Guantanamo is that when they set up that prison 12 years ago, lots of men were brought there as suspected members of the security detail of Osama bin Laden. Because, remember, this was January 2002, just months after September 11th, and the United States was desperate to find bin Laden. And so as they were gathering up these so-called foreign fighters in Afghanistan, young Arab men, many of them of Yemeni background, they were looking for people who could lead them back to bin Laden. So people who met a certain profile, who were captured in a certain place in a certain time, in the opposite direction of where we now learn bin Laden went, were initially profiled as bodyguards, bin Laden bodyguards. Many of those men, who were initially described and called the Dirty 30, but eventually many more than 30 men would be profiled as bin Laden bodyguards, many of those men have been let go. They've gone back to their countries, and we haven't heard from many of them. And I think, you know, what we've learned since then in the intervening dozen years is we didn't profile very well. People we considered bodyguards probably weren't bodyguards, or definitely weren't bodyguards, or in some instances, maybe never even met Osama bin Laden. So, yes, he was one time described as a bodyguard. Osama bin Laden's dead. He's made an argument that he wants to go home to Yemen, get a wife, get on with his life. And a panel of U.S. intelligence representatives of six different agencies of the U.S. government have agreed that he should no longer be classified as that forever prisoner and should have a shot at going home once the U.S. sorts out what happens with the Yemenis.
As we know, Carol, President Obama signed an executive order just about 5 years ago this month, closing the detention facility. Based on your reporting, is there something the president could have done in the last 5 years to close Guantanamo?
Well, it's very interesting. There's been a lot of debate on why that went so poorly and why he wasn't able to make good on his promise. And one of the things is, you know, when President Bush decided he was going to open Guantanamo, he didn't ask permission of anyone. One day, we reporters were put on a plane down there to see this prison camp that was going to be opened, and within days, the prisoners started coming. The president comes in, and he decides he's going to do this a little bit more systematically and by consensus, and Congress
pushes back.
They didn't want it. They, threw up hurdles in the way. The question is, I suppose, if the president had acted quickly and picked up everybody and moved them to U.S. soil in the beginning before they used their purse strings to block it, would Guantanamo be closed or would Guantanamo be elsewhere? Because the thing about closing Guantanamo is you can empty that prison camp and you can still continue a kind of indefinite detention without charge at another location, and have you really closed Guantanamo? Part of what the president envisions or has envisioned in the past is continuing this indefinite detention regime. So emptying a prison at Guantanamo doesn't end Guantanamo detention. It becomes a question of what does closing Guantanamo mean and whether he can accomplish it both geographically and kind of like policy-wise institutionally by ending what Guantanamo has come to mean.
Well, on that note, as always, Carol Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. She's military affairs correspondent for the Miami Herald. We have Marine Major General Michael Leonard waiting in the wings. He ran the detention center for the first almost 100 days. Stay with us. We are marking, I guess, the 12th anniversary of the arrival of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
Gabriela Quintero of the Mexican guitar duo Rodrigo y Gabriela says her style has a surprising inspiration.
And I knew that you can develop some rhythms watching some of the flamenco guys, so I tried to guess what the flamenco guys were playing.
Flamenco meets metal, this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll hear from a young woman whose poem has gone viral. It's about how girls learn from their mothers to shrink themselves.
The burden of this house has followed me across the country. I asked 5 questions in genetics class today, and all of them started with the word sorry.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're marking the 12th anniversary of the first arrival of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moscoen. Joining us now is retired Marine Major General Michael Leonard, who established the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay as head of a joint task force. He was there when the first detainees arrived on January 11th, 2002, and worked to create a humane environment under very difficult circumstances. He wrote in a recent commentary that Guantanamo never should have been opened and that it's time to close it now. And he joins us from the studios of Interlaken. And General Leonard, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
I know you were listening in as I was talking with our first guest, Carol Rosenberg. Are you surprised that Guantanamo is still open now, 12 years later?
Not entirely. I've watched Guantanamo going through the various efforts to close it. During even the Bush administration, there were many of the folks that were responsible for policy who came forward and said it needed to be closed, and obviously President Obama made that as one of his campaign promises, but I've watched it over the years, I knew it was going to take a long time. It was going to be very difficult. I'm a part of a group of 50 right. over 50 retired flag officers who have all recommended that Guantanamo be closed.
Well, and just picking up on something that Carol Rosenberg asked, which is, what does it mean to close Guantanamo, which I think is a very interesting, provocative question. You have called for its closure. What does that mean to you?
Well, first off, it means the closure of the actual physical facility at Guantanamo. In order to do that, obviously, the 77 who have been cleared by competent authority will need to be returned to either their country of origin or a country that is willing to take them, because Carol is exactly correct. Not every country is either prepared to take them because of perhaps their own human rights record or because of our concerns that they will be mistreated when they get there. But I think there's some cause for some optimism. The last three Uyghurs, of course, just left and were resettled in Slovakia. So I think in answer to your question, obviously those that have been identified for indefinite detention would need to be moved to the United States. And that portion of the legislation that was introduced by Senator Carl Levin was not supported in a bipartisan fashion, although fast-tracking the movement of those who have been cleared for detention did receive bipartisan support. So it's going to take some legal action on the part of our Congress to authorize those remaining for detention, indefinite detention, to be moved to the United States. I'd also add, though, that the Periodic Review Board needs to complete the 70 that are left. But I am made more optimistic by the fact that they did recently clear this one individual, and Carol's already talked about that.
Well, but should the American people expect, even demand, a zero recidivism rate? As we know, people that go to prison in this country, the recidivism rate is pretty high. Should we have those same expectations for detainees or prisoners from Guantanamo?
No, I don't think that's reasonable to expect that. I've maintained all along that that there will be recidivism. But at the same time, we are a nation of laws, and our Constitution is a remarkable document. I think that our adherence to the law, our own laws, trumps the potential danger, and there is a potential danger, that some of these individuals will become recidivists. But we have pretty good biometrics on them. We have the finest military in the world. And frankly, if they do decide to go back to the fight, we can find them. But I think what we stand for as a nation, what we say we stand for, trumps that manageable risk, and it is a manageable risk.
Well, and as we know, over the last couple of years, there has been pushback from both Democrats and Republicans to this idea of closing Guantanamo and sending the prisoners to, a federal system on the mainland here in the United States. It seems like a bipartisan pushback against President Obama.
Well, there was a bipartisan pushback, but we're beginning to see a change and recognition on both sides of the aisle that this can't continue forever. We recently saw Senator McCain lead an effort to support Senator Levin's language. So I'm perhaps a bit more optimistic because the time is right. Afghanistan is winding down. The administration has assigned special envoys in the White House, the Department of Defense, and the Department of State move towards the closure of Guantanamo. And that was the reason I wrote the op-ed at the time I did, because I felt that the timing was right.
I'd like to go back 12 years. You were there for the arrival of those detainees, and as Carol was describing for us, and she was there when they arrived, and I think we all have the images of people with hoods over their heads in jumpsuits, handcuffed, and being put in these cages. Why cages?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is it was a matter of how much time I was given to build the detention facility. When I received the order to form a joint task force made up of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard, I was given 96 hours to form that task force, deploy from all over the country, arrive in Guantanamo, and have the first 100 cells built. We managed to meet that deadline, but the visuals were clearly bad. Essentially, what we had them in were cages. And we immediately began working to improve the quality of the infrastructure. There were a couple of reasons why the administration felt it was so important to move these detainees so quickly. Part of it was the conditions in Afghanistan were arguably much worse than they were in Guantanamo. The weather there, of course, as you know, it was January, and the infrastructure in Afghanistan is pretty bad. Some of these detainees had some significant medical problems and needed to be treated. And, Guantanamo has been used by many administrations for the flotsam and jetsam of U.S. foreign policy. I was in charge of the Cuban migrant camps back in 1995. And so decisions have been made by administrations on both sides of the aisle to use Guantanamo. But it's time to close it. We need to adhere to the Constitution and to the Geneva Convention and put this behind us.
You described the kind of flotsam and jetsam, but many of these detainees described as the worst of the worst. Were they?
Yeah, we do have some very bad people in Guantanamo right now, and that's going to have to be dealt with. But I would agree with Carol that our initial ability to sort out the really bad actors was not particularly good. There have been 779 people who have been incarcerated in Guantanamo. Of those, 644 have been let go. So that would reflect to me that that we have not exercised the discrimination that we should have. And in point of fact, early in the war, we were paying for information, and in many cases, the Afghans were using that as an opportunity to either settle old scores or make some money.
I mean, the idea that you might have had a conflict with a neighbor in Afghanistan, and so you essentially sold them to the U.S. military?
That's very possible that happened, yes.
These were supposed to be fighters in the war on terror, as it has been described, with some degree of intelligence, that they were supposed to help the military interrogators understand more about who we were fighting in Afghanistan. Based on those first, 90 to 100 days, did they meet that criterion for you?
Some did, but most did not. While I was there, we had 300 detainees there from 33 different nations. Some did meet that criterion, but many were low-level fighters who had been just picked up, swept up, and in many cases, particularly those who were not native Afghans, had questionable reasons for why they were there. Some had just simply joined the fight. Others were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But those that were fighters, and there were many, were low level with not very much really good intel for us.
And that's a retired Marine Major General Michael Leonard. He established the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. He was there for the arrival of the first detainees, which happened on January 11th, 2002. And that was, of course, 12 years ago. And wrote a recent commentary that Guantanamo never should have been opened and that it was time to close it now. I should add that he was profiled in Karen Greenberg's book, The Least Worst Place. And I interviewed Carol about our guest. And you can listen to my interview, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And of course, you can join us here on Radio Times. Any questions or comments you might have, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. General, did these early detainees, did they know why they were in Guantanamo?
Well, most of them had an idea that, you know, that why they were there. Their biggest concern, of course, was what's going to happen to them. You know, this is one of the reasons why I feel that it's necessary to move forward into the federal court system, because, you know, we've watched the recent rise of more hunger strikes, and whether you want to call it a hunger strike or a hunger strike light, you know, we need to get these cases resolved, and we either need to determine whether or not they can be tried, we need to let them go. But the first part of the process is this periodic review board. And so there's 70 more that need to go through that process. And, you know, we're encouraging that process to move forward as rapidly as possible.
I remember interviewing Karen Greenberg about you in her book. And there was a hunger strike when you were there. And she describes you pleading with the detainees to eat and drink.
Yeah. You know, I have a high regard for Karen, and we talked about that after the book came out, because you know, she interviewed a number of detainees, and you know, I Marine generals don't normally plead. I didn't see it as a pleading, but you know, I was remembered by some of the detainees she interviewed as the one that seemed to demonstrate some concern for their welfare. So I was probably given a better character than perhaps I deserved, but I was extraordinarily concerned about their well-being. You know, the point is that regardless of whether or not they are bad people, and some of them were, I felt that you know, as a commissioned officer in the United States Marine Corps, who we say we stand for, and as a nation, the fact that we take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States is extraordinarily important to me.
But, you know, as you said, you were given 96 hours. That's just a couple of days to get this facility up and running. Were you getting conflicting orders from your superiors about what you were supposed to do at Guantanamo?
Well, you know, I think that the best way to describe it is that the policy was being built as we went along. And, you know, I want to be fair in that there were some overriding concerns as to why we could not leave these detainees in Afghanistan. So I understand the pressures that were placed upon the administration, and I'm not blind to the fact that, you know, we were a nation that had been attacked and severely damaged, and we were angry, and there was a lot of political pressure to do something. But at the same time, I think it probably would have been better, with the benefit of hindsight, had there been more time to work through the policy and then establish the camp, if that was a fact, what they would have determined was necessary.
And by, you said, more time to look at the policy and come to a different kind of conclusion about how to treat these detainees, how to view them?
Yeah, I think, for example, the decision to be guided by the Geneva Conventions but not to necessarily follow them was a slippery slope, it concerns me. You know, I recognize that these detainees did not fall under the strict interpretation of a prisoner of war as defined by some lawyers in the administration. But, you know, it's a pretty good document, and it's an international document that's been agreed to by many countries. And it would have been a much better roadmap than kind of making up the policy as we went along, because obviously we're where we are today.
But do you feel like you were in conflict, and perhaps in conflict with your superiors, that you wanted something that they did not want?
Conflict is too strong a word. I knew I was down there for a short time because my command was force listed in the event that we're going to be invading Iraq, and mm-hmm. I was told initially that I would only be down there for 60 days. It worked out to almost 100, but conflict does not accurately describe it. I was given an opportunity to make my case to the senior leaders that came down. You know, I argued for Article 5 hearings and was not successful there. Mm-hmm. I argued to get the ICRC in. Ultimately, we were successful. That's the International Committee of the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that this was not a conflict, but there was a vigorous debate on how to move forward.
But do you think Guantanamo Bay and how prisoners have been treated in that facility for the last 12 years, do you think that has hurt the United States?
Absolutely. In the aftermath of 9/11, I think we had the support and the empathy of every civilized nation on earth. At the same time, if you think about what terrorists try to do, they try to change who you are, and they try to make you afraid. And by that standard, we actually did exactly what the terrorists wanted. We changed who we said we were, and we acted as if we were afraid. And I don't think that's helped mm-hmm. us in our standing in the international community.
You have come out publicly, wrote a piece, commentary last month in December to close the facility and to say that it never should have been opened in the first place. Is this something that has haunted you for the last 12 years?
Haunted is perhaps too strong a word, but I believe in the Constitution. I believe who we are as a nation of laws, and I would like to think that after 37 years of active duty, that mm-hmm. I've acted in an honorable fashion. And so, when the opportunity presented itself to speak out on closure of Guantanamo, I did so. But I've been fairly consistent in that. That position. It's just simply that I think because of timing and everything else, that the article I wrote received quite a bit of attention. Mm.
And attention hoping to persuade what members of Congress to take a harder, longer look at this issue?
Yes, I think it's time. The question that I would ask of our lawmakers and any administration that follows is, how long do we intend to hold people without the benefit of any type of a trial? And what happens as they reach a geriatric age? Just how much danger do they actually pose to us?
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with retired Marine Major General Michael Leonard. He ran the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay for the first almost 100 days. He was there when the first detainees arrived on January 11th, 2002. Joining us in this hour of Radio Times as we are marking that 12th anniversary, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Meadowbrook School, located in Abington Township, supports WHYY and is an independent, small-by-design elementary school for children in grades preschool through 6th. Education at Meadowbrook emphasizes a lifelong love of learning, encourages both creative and critical thinking, expands a sense of integrity, and inspires students to make a positive difference. To learn more, there is a Meadowbrook Open House on Sunday, January 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. Registration at themeadowbrookschool.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She grew up in a drug-ravaged South Bronx neighborhood. She says the tragedy she saw there helped her understand that as a judge,
the people who came before me as defendants were human beings with good and potentially very bad things within them.
Her memoir is out in paperback. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
How often do you find yourself thinking, I can squeeze one more thing in, I don't need to rest? Well, therapist Stephanie Brown writes about this thought process as being unsustainable and damaging in her new book, Speed, Our Addiction to Faster and Faster. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about our need for speed. Today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with retired Major General Michael Leonard, the first commander of the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And he joins us to talk about those first almost 100 days when he did head up that facility. And last month, he wrote an op-ed and joined a number of other flag officials who have called for the closure of Guantanamo Bay. He also has said that it never should have been opened in the first place. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Rick from, looks like, New Tripoli, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. And Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was, General Leonard said earlier in the conversation that it was time to bring those detainees to the United States, and it just seems to me that Guantanamo as a military base, you know, is part of the United States, at least under the agreements that have been made there. And what would be the benefit to bringing, say, all those detainees to the continental United States versus staying at Guantanamo Bay as part of the United States?
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. General Leonard?
Well, thank you, Rick, for the question. I am not an attorney, but the laws of the U.S. do not apply in Guantanamo. It is considered a base on foreign soil. And so, for example, the laws of habeas corpus and things of this nature do not apply. And so it is always fulfilled an extra legal type of status. And I'm arguing that that we need to relook that and bring them to the United States.
Rick, thanks for your call to Radio Times. So you were interviewed by Carol Rosenberg, our first guest, and I'm looking at some of what you said to her. You said, I'm not a fan of having military commissions. I think our federal courts have actually had a pretty good track record of handling terrorism cases since 9/11. Can you expand on that?
Sure. There's been nearly 500 terrorism cases since 9/11 that federal criminal courts have successfully adjudicated. Military commissions have produced 7 convictions, and only 3 of those convicted remain at Guantanamo. You know, the federal courts have more than 200 years of experience. They can try suspects for conspiracy and material support, in addition to countless other offenses not available before military commissions, including fraud, immigration, firearm, and drug charges. So it would seem to me, once again, I'm not a lawyer,
right,
but that the federal courts would be the place for this. Additionally, you know, one of the arguments for the military commissions is that we are at war. The question is that once we no longer have active combat operations in Afghanistan, are we at war?
Which is an interesting question, and if the timetable holds, we would be largely out of Afghanistan in a year's time.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess the question then being, what do we do with these detainees that have been held because of the war on terrorism?
That's correct.
Are you concerned that the American people have forgotten about Guantanamo and forgotten about the challenging issues that it has raised over these last 12 years?
I am. I would suspect that our lawmakers don't receive a lot of pressure from their constituents to close Guantanamo. But I think that we need to ask ourselves, as Americans, what we stand for and whether or not Guantanamo is something that we should be proud of.
And I'm interested just a little bit about you, about how you ended up heading up this facility when these detainees first arrived. And you had been there, what, in the 90s?
Yes, that's correct. In 1995, I was in charge of the security for the Cuban and Haitian camps. The Cubans often referred to as the Bolseros. And the unit that I commanded was during the 9/11 was also identified as the unit that would be the first responder in the event of another migrant crisis. So I had the experience, and obviously I was in command of the unit that would go down to Guantanamo if we had another migrant crisis. But there is a vast difference between migrants who have arguably not broken any laws of the United States unless they finally reach U.S. soil, and detainees who, of course, were believed to be involved in terrorism. So there was quite a bit of difference. But, in point of fact, there was no U.S. unit at that time with a great deal of experience in operating a enemy prisoner of war camp.
And where did you go after Guantanamo?
I returned back to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and then sometime later, I led about 5,000 of my Marines and sailors in the initial invasion of Iraq.
Wow. And you were there on the ground as we invaded that country?
Yes, I was.
When you were at Guantanamo, and of course you were there for the first couple of months, was there interrogation taking place at that facility?
It began under a different joint task force. One of the decisions that was made by the administration was to form two joint task forces. Joint Task Force 160, which is the joint task force that I commanded, was responsible solely for security and incarceration of the detainees. Joint Task Force 170 was responsible for interrogation.
And what, they just operated separate from you? Did you know what was going on there? Well, potentially what did go on
well,
there?
Well, at the time that while I was there, I insisted that the guards that I had remain with the detainees and to ensure that they were being properly treated. I can't speak to what happened after I left.
Oh, but were you concerned that they wouldn't be properly treated?
I was concerned that we would adhere to the Geneva Conventions. Now, obviously, Geneva Conventions does not afford interrogation. And I recognized that the administration really was concerned about finding Osama bin Laden and those of his ilk who had planned the attack on 9/11. So I understood and appreciated that, but at the same time, I recognized that I had a responsibility to ensure the decent and humane treatment of these detainees, no matter what they had done.
But it sounds like you were concerned or perhaps even a little suspicious about what was going on?
Concerned, yes.
You keep correcting my language, and I appreciate
that. No, that's quite all right.
No. But you did call in the ICRC.
Yes, we asked for the ICRC to come in because, in the Marine Corps, we work with the ICRC in our exercises. They come in. We know how they operate. It used to be said that if you ever taken prisoner yourself other than a battalion of Marines to come and rescue you, you'd want to see the ICRC. They're professional, and they have experience in working in these areas.
You also, and this is, of course, the early days at Guantanamo, brought in a Muslim chaplain. And I'm assuming probably most or maybe even all of the guards at Guantanamo didn't speak the language, and we're probably talking about many different languages.
Yes. Well, first off, I don't know if you're talking about the guards or the detainees, but the detainees spoke a number of different languages. Mm-hmm. The most common two languages to communicate with them was English and Arabic. But yes, I did bring in one of the three Muslim chaplains that was in the U.S. Navy at the time. And at that time, Lieutenant Saif al-Islam was his name, and he did a remarkable job. One of the decisions I made immediately was to ensure that he wore the uniform at all times when he would interact with the detainees and our Muslims who were our interpreters. But I wanted him to interact with the detainees in uniform so that they could see that we were a nation not only of laws, but of supported religious beliefs, and that we had a Muslim chaplain. I want them to see that.
And I'm assuming you talked to some of these detainees, and I'm curious about what you wanted to know, what questions you had.
Well, I was, one of the things that I did, Marty, was I spent a lot of time in the facility, and I would show up unannounced in the middle of the night. And there were some reasons for that, and particularly because, I recognized that there was a lot of concern on the part of those service members who were holding these folks, because they were angry. They're young people, and I did not want to see any type of human rights abuse. So I was very visible. And in the course of that, particularly in these types of cells, you can't avoid having some interaction. My impression of most of the detainees was that they were what I would describe as losers. Mm. Carol Rosenberg already wrote about this.
Yeah, I'm looking at that now. Yeah.
Many of them described to me failed marriages, failed businesses, essentially they were in Afghanistan, and so they claimed at least, searching for, the meaning of life. In point of fact, blaming all of their problems in the past on Americans, the Jews, the Israelis, but anything but themselves. These, for the most part, did not represent Muslim society or Arab society as I suspect most people would know it.
And they were young and old, and I guess everything in between.
Yes, there were some that were quite old. Most of them, though, were under 30, and giving support for the belief that they were low-level rank-and-file fighters, and many of them were, I suspect. Mm.
And did they want to talk to you?
And many of them did, and most of them wanting to know what was going to happen to them.
Mm. Again, going back to Carol's piece, she asked you about regrets. I have many regrets, but calling the worst of the worst is not one of them. The regret you had was allowing guards to tape over their names on their uniforms. Why?
Let me say I had two regrets, and I think Carol talked about the other one as well. I really wish that we had done Article 5 hearings as required by the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. I think that would have helped us with the sorting process, and that would have meant that many of those folks wouldn't have arrived here in the first place. The second one, though, is in direct response to your question, is the decision to allow on a voluntary basis those mostly soldiers who had a tough job of guarding these detainees, and who were concerned that that they may be the topic for or their families may be the subject of retribution. Other service members just made the decision, as I did, to leave the name tags on. I'm not saying that I had no concerns, but I really felt that it's important to have accountability. And one of my regrets is that became a policy, as I understand it, and that in future prisoner of war facilities or EPW facilities, name tags were not worn. And I think that gives a certain level of anonymity that perhaps makes a guard feel that they have more latitude than they should have.
Mm, the idea is that they might be overly punitive or maybe even torture somebody because their name is covered up?
Yes.
And that was a concern that you had, or a regret that you had as well?
Yeah, it is. I felt your identity is not something that should be kept secret from anybody, mm-hmm. not at least under those conditions.
After you left Guantanamo, did you ever have contact with your successors, people that took over after you?
Yeah, I did, because I was brought back to U.S. Southern Command as the chief of staff, so I had contact with a number of the Joint Task Force commanders.
And did they have questions for you?
Yes, some did.
And did you feel like you could relay some of the concerns that we have been talking about?
Yeah, and I might add that, a couple of the commanders shared those concerns.
Mm. And the fact that you have spoken out, is that because you're retired and that has given you a kind of a freedom that you might not have had if you hadn't retired yet?
Well, first off, you know, general officers, regardless of how senior, do not make policy. Our elected leaders make policy, and that's a good thing. But I had actually, in direct response to interviewers' questions, had said that Guantanamo needed to be closed before I retired. I'm just getting a lot of attention right now because it's an anniversary and because of the op-ed and some other circumstances. But, you know, one of the responsibilities that an officer has as well is to be honest. So, you know, I had spoken out or had responded to questions even while I was on active duty. But at the same time, our responsibility is to execute policy and not to make it.
Has the White House reached out to you, or are there members who signed this paper closing, calling for the closure of Guantanamo?
Well, in terms of the retired flag officers, I've been in communication with a number of them regarding the closing. And no, the White House has not specifically reached out to me, no.
Would you have advice for President Obama if he were to ask it of you? And I realize that's probably not going to happen, but I'd be curious because of your unique position.
Well, I am not in the business of giving advice to any of our elected leaders, particularly the president. But you know, if asked, what I would say is that we may be at that crucial point in history where we have the opportunity to close this facility. I know that was one of his campaign promises, and I'm sure that he's looking at his legacy now that he's in his second administration, and that the time is now and that we need to move forward.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times and sharing some of your perspective on this very important issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's retired Marine Major General Michael Leonard, the first commander of the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. And he joined us from the Interlaken studios. We began our conversation with Carol Rosenberg. She's military affairs correspondent at the Miami Herald, has been writing about the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay since the first detainees arrived. That was in 2002, 12 years ago, just this past weekend. Go to hyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can send us an email. You can check out the podcasts, Facebook and Twitter as well. Also go to our homepage and leave us a comment at hyy.org/radiotimes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.